in the larger scheme of things, what is half $1 billion in a $40 billion project? Good morning and welcome to Talk to Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Alaska has the gas, the nation needs it, but it's going to cost a lot to deliver it. So we have a Gas Line Inducement Act, and the man in charge of it is our guest today. Our number statewide and toll-free, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. TransCanada was responsive to AGEA, Denali was not. What's that really mean? That's the subject on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
So, when they went to hire somebody to be the AGEA coordinator, the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act coordinator, that was created by the legislature, the position sat open for a while, and then they found just the right person for it because he was no longer running the U.S. Geological Survey. A new administration had come in, and he had left. He had left the U.S. Interior Department and come back to Alaska. Mark Myers, we're glad you're back.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad to be here.
And I'm glad you could come in here and help deconstruct AGEA, because this seems to be a situation that everybody's got something to say, but it's not necessarily real closely tied to the facts, because there's so much at stake. You know, an immense construction project, a financing challenge, the like of which I don't know when anyone's ever seen, cryptic geology, perhaps, but you come out of geology, so perhaps you can correct me on that. Perhaps the geology is not as cryptic as everybody says. But nonetheless, tell me what your day consists of now that the open season has started. Do you have to talk? Do you do research? What happens in a day for you that you don't come into a radio station?
Well, every day is a bit different. First of all, we do a lot of, as the position sounds like, it's a coordinator's position, so we're coordinating a lot of different efforts. Of course, on a project this big that, you know, crosses 1,700 miles, two countries, through really diverse terrain from the North Slope all the way down through an incredible diverse set of environments, to provide a huge quantity of natural gas to the country and to Alaskans, you can imagine the number of stakeholders involved. So first and foremost is under the Act, you know, one of the great challenges are the environmental coordination necessary to build the project and get an environmental impact statement done. Under this project, under federal law, there's an expedited process of 18 months. But the work in front of that, in order to make sure that we have all the data, the agencies are aligned, parties are working together, stakeholders are engaged, is a big job. So we work closely with the Office of the Federal Coordinator. We work closely with the folks in many agencies. There are over 30 different government agencies that are involved with this. At the same time, we work closely within the state government. We work closely with Commissioner Bishop in Labor to make sure that you know, we have trained Alaskans are ready to go. We work closely with our commercial team to make sure that, again, the project monitoring, the reimbursement process is working. We do the best we can to communicate with the legislature so they're aware of how their money's being spent. And, of course, we want to make sure, again, that the public's informed. So we try our best to do what we can. My office only consists of three people, myself and two others. And so we're small, but we try to stay incredibly busy. So a lot of coordination, communication. There's always education. We want to know what the competing market's doing out there. People have questions on Lower 48 shale gas, market demand. So we work closely with consultants, with world-class consultants, to understand what the gas market looks like now, how it's changing, what the future might look like that might affect the competitiveness of this project. So again, lots of different variations on the theme, but all very important. And again, one of the most important thing we can do is to communicate with the public, which is why I go on radio shows.
All right. Well, good. AGEA, as I understand it, is essentially a set of it's a commitment of state financing, state funds at certain strategic points. In other words, benchmarks have to be met by TransCanada. And I guess TransCanada is the real partner, but somehow ExxonMobil is involved. In other words, they're interested and they're kind of in partnership with TransCanada, but yet they haven't signed on to a GIA. So maybe we can start with that. What is the first benchmark we need to be looking at where the state actually has to pony up some money? I guess it's already spending on environmental impact statement.
We are certainly reimbursing the project for right now up to 50% of the legitimate reimbursable costs of the project, and post-open season will be 90% up to the $500 million. And that money goes on many fronts. It goes for moving the project forward. It pays for engineering costs, development costs, design costs, open season regulatory costs, fieldwork costs. And those are primary.
So you've got there's three of you, and I'm just thinking of Bernie Washington, our book guy. You know, he's a chief financial officer here at our little corporation here, and he's got his hands full with it, tracking everybody's budget and their expenditures and whatnot. And I'm thinking, here's these three people, and here's all this money at stake. And what do you actually have to sign a purchase order here for? 90% of this, and
well, there's three of us. That's in the a coordinator's office. Uh-huh. Now, many state agencies are contributing to the effort, and uh-huh. the lead two commissioners are the Commissioner of Natural Resources and the Commissioner of Department of Revenue.
I see. So they would go into that department for this particular line of
yes. The commissioners are actively involved, as is Deputy Commissioner of DNR Marty Rutherford, who does overall coordination of all aspects, including the commercial aspects. Within that, then, we have team members that are sort of, I would say, matrixed or are in addition to their normal day job, are working hard on this gas line as well.
I think you just invented a verb there.
I do love those movies, by the way. So we have really a full team of folks. My office are either the first dedicated positions to this job. Other departments do have positions that have been funded by the legislature. For instance, labor has folks, transportation has folks working on this issue. The majority of the folks are in the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas, Commissioner's Office of Natural Resources, yeah. and Department of Revenue and their audit staff and some of their commercial yeah. staff.
We've had Marty Rutherford in here twice, and she has always said to us, just anytime you got any questions, you know, I'm glad to come in, whatever, explain it. But of course, she's very, very hard to reach because she's always on the phone. I'll bet you the first thing she said when she looked into your eyes is, "Boy, am I glad to see you." There's a lady who's been carrying quite a load.
She's been carrying a tremendous load, and the whole team has. And again, I came in after the AG Act was passed, so they had done a tremendous amount of research and background, and I would commend the listeners to get on the state website under gasline.alaska.gov and look at the finding document. It's a masterpiece of work, but it has a lot of very specific detail on this pipeline project, breaks it down. Although it's dated by a few years, it has held up remarkably well. And I say dated, the cost assumptions in there were pre the open season costs, where again, several hundred million dollars more of funding has been put forward to get better cost estimates. But the numbers are remarkably similar to what the states and the state's consultants came up with. So there's a tremendous amount of valued information in there. And then that work, that team did just a Herculean effort in developing that finding and the documents that support that.
Do you think when the legislature, in its wisdom, passed AGIA, that they had any idea that the price of natural gas would fall to where it is today?
I think we have seen a huge number of changes that no one would have predicted, both positive and negative, with respect to the project. First of all, you can look at the falling of natural gas prices, and then you can put in perspective of we're in the Great Recession, the worst recession in the last 70 years. It's been a remarkable change in the U.S. economy and the world economy, and we're, of course, not out of that yet by most people's calculations. So we've hit a period of time where demand has actually decreased, and there are very few times in U.S. history where we have seen energy demand actually decrease in this country and industrial capacity collapse as much as it has. So we have seen a huge change. Now, no one believes that change is going to be sustained. So when you look out there in the long term, you know, in the term of this project, 2018-2020 timeframe, and you look at the projections 5 years ago versus now, they're actually more bullish. on natural gas. And that's the other component of this, is there is a growing recognition that natural gas is the preferred fuel, that it can bridge us, it's low carbon, environmentally preferable. And you can just look at recent events in the Gulf and the shock wave on oil. There's a desire to find other sources of energy, cleaner burning sources of energy to replace oil over time. Now, that's not going to happen in a decade or two or three, but will happen gradually. So natural gas, seen as a preferred fuel, is being heard more and more. So in the last few years, that knowledge base has grown. At the same time, we might have wished that prior to more domestic unconventional gas coming online, but we couldn't deliver it until Alaska Gas would come online. So that gap between Alaska Gas and Lower 48 declining production was always problematic. So the source of that natural gas would be imported LNG, putting us much in the same economic condition that we were with imported oil, and not a desired position to be importing your natural gas as well as your oil. So what happened is, with the development of these larger non-conventional resources, the country really could look at becoming much more energy independent. So that change is a huge dynamic. It's both good for Lower 48 markets, but it's good for this price, this project as well. And then if you look at long-term prices, the question is, what kind of prices do you sustain the overall development of natural gas in this country, including this project, including Lower 48 non-conventional gases? So when you look at those future projections, they're still in very good positions for this project. And if you look, the most recent Energy Information Agency 2010 outlook has prices for this project that put this project very solidly in the money. So we're still
EIA,
positive, yes.
And your consultants are...
Consultants, major oil companies, there's not a lot of differences I've seen in the various experts' opinions.
Well, what if it just seems like the supply and demand is so unknown? I mean, for instance, if Congress, the House bill obviously is not going to be what Congress passes, but there's so much pressure to do something about climate warming in Congress. And the latest one is, well, maybe we just go for the low-hanging fruit. Maybe we just do carbon caps on utilities, because some utilities, they want carbon caps anyway. Well, isn't that great news for the natural gas market?
Depending on how they design incentives. And really, I think the good news is that natural gas is the only fuel that can be brought in quick enough and in quantities large enough to really change the CO2 footprint with respect to electrical generation and potentially with transportation. If you look at
what I'm wondering is, and you're a geologist, you know, I'm a talk radio person. We're guessing, but don't you see that there could be like a kind of a tipping point? If Congress makes that decision, the whole world is watching, and all of a sudden, flop. You know, he flops his microphone over, and no, all of a sudden, ooh. Our demand projection is all of a sudden going like this instead of like that.
If you really want to do something about CO2, and reduce dramatically, particularly in electrical generation, you want to use more electricity for transportation, et cetera, more electric cars, more hybrids. If you want to go that direction, then you have to generate your electricity from new sources of energy. And if you look at the sources available and the time we're talking about, natural gas should be the fuel of choice. We have to make decisions. Right now, you know, we do not have affordable clean coal technology. We do not have large-scale effective sequestration of CO2 to remove from coal-fired power plants. So using a low-carbon fuel is the quickest, most expedient, and most cost-effective method for getting to a lower carbon future. So hopefully the energy policy in Washington would represent and understand that. And again, that doesn't preclude, that should increase renewables. But if we look at the overall energy picture for the U.S., you know, we're right now about 8% non-carbon fuel-based or non-fossil fuel-based for our total energy picture, 8%. Optimistically, in 2035, with great conservation efforts and a great push for renewables, from new solar, wind, et cetera, we're 14% use of that fuel. We've increased by 6%, or still 78% dependent on fossil fuels in those numbers. So you can see the magnitude of energy we use and requires us, if we make a transition, to use a readily available existing technology, existing infrastructure type solution, if you really want to deal with decreasing carbon in the very near term.
Our guest is Mark Myers. He is the state's AGIA coordinator, of the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. And there are probably listeners right now, Mark, who are wondering, what's his politics? Whose line are we hearing? And you told me at the beginning of the show, before we started, you said, look, I'm not in a political party.
Right. I'm a classic Alaskan. I belong to neither Republican or Democratic Party, and I haven't before. So I'm a scientist. I try to look at issues rationally, scientifically, and look at realistic economics and fact patterns.
Mm-hmm. And this was when you ran the USGS, and the new administration came in and didn't want you there. Was that...
Well, the new administration has the right. When you accept one of these jobs, they get to make their decisions on who they keep. And the Department of Interior, they decided they wanted to change out the entire organization, and you have to respect their right to do that. And the survey was objective and independent under my leadership, and I believe it will stay that way under the new director. So again, it was a great job and a great opportunity, and I fully respect their right to put in that job whoever they think
is
appropriate.
So it doesn't reflect a partisan persuasion on your part, at least from the way you look at it.
No, not at all. In fact, I had great bipartisan support when I was at the survey in Congress.
Yeah. Our guest then is Mark Myers. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. You can also participate by email. You can sit there and think about it and punch a key and change your mind and like that. talk@aprn.org. It's a local telephone call if you're in Anchorage at 550-8422. Mark, is your office in Anchorage?
It is. Yeah, it's.
So are you in the Atwood building? Or?
We are. We are for now. We'll be moving in a little bit of time. Space.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I see that the pipeline regulators, they're moving. And so where will you be going?
We're actually going to move over to the ConocoPhillips building in some independent space over there. We just simply not enough space to put our folks together. We have authorization for 5 new positions, these positions that we badly need as the environmental regulatory process heats up.
So you're going one block away.
We're going staying as close as we can to get consolidated space. It was actually considerably cheaper for us than the space the federal regulators were moving into. We looked at that space, but it was about half the cost, so we elected the cheaper cost alternative.
Yeah. Well, they'll be down there with Larry Pursley.
Yeah. Larry's got a great team.
He's not in D.C.
No. Larry and his deputy is a wonderful Admiral Barrett, and he is a very, 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 very good team.
I have really been enjoying all of the gas line people that we've had on this show, you and Marty and Larry, and as far the industry people as well, have all been amazingly forthcoming, and it's really been interesting because that's not what you expect. I mean, there are highly charged politics here, but somehow we do seem to still be able to get down to some kind of factual basis. And I guess the factual basis I want to take up is why would anybody in their right mind finance a pipeline at what, maybe $40 billion, where they have not proven reserves of that extent to feed the pipeline, Mark?
Well, the first thing you have to recognize is almost all large pipeline projects are built without full mono reserves to amortize it over a 30, 40, or 50-year time period. So in this case, we have about 36 trillion cubic feet of resource. At the scale of the project design at 4.5 billion cubic feet per day, those resources won't last the full 30 years. On the out years, it would be new resources have to be found or developed. Now, we know there are lots of other resources on the North Slope, in fact, up to another 200 trillion cubic feet of technically recoverable, undiscovered resources.
So in other words, Prudhoe right now has how much?
Prudhoe has about 23 to 26 trillion cubic feet. Point Thompson, 8 to 10 trillion cubic feet. Other associated fields we know have natural gas like Alpine, et cetera, North Star. So when you add it up, we have between 18 and at full capacity, 18 and 20 years of natural gas. And ideally, you would like to have 30 years. Now, the resources are there. I will say unconventional resources like natural gas hydrates exist within the infrastructure. Many more trillion cubic feet of natural gas exist right within the Prudhoe Bay area. But again, it's non-conventional. We know there's significant natural gas in the foothills. We know along the coastline of Alaska onshore as well there is. And pretty much almost every exploration well that's ever been drilled in the North Slope has encountered natural gas.
I get the feeling you're tiptoeing through a geological minefield here.
Well, a geologist's paradise, I'll say. You know, years ago when I did the exploration business, you know, we considered discovery of gas a failure. I'll put it that way. It'll be a lot more fun to have that on the success leg.
Yeah, and I guess they still flare at Prudhoe Bay.
They do not. They only flare in cases of testing or in cases of basically they have to lower pressure on an emergency basis. The gas is preserved. It's recycled into the field and used for pressure maintenance.
Ah, that's different.
Or for fuel.
Different than the last time I was up there. Let's start with some calls. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right, 1-800-478-8255. Statewide. In Anchorage, it's a local call 550-8422 and email is talk@aprn.org. It's all wide open. The lines are open too. And our first caller is from Port Alexander. Peter, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Mark Myers.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Mark, I have a pretty simple question, but it's I scratch my head about it. You know, if you say it's going to cost $40 billion to get this pipeline built.
Well, I said that.
And
he didn't say that. I said that.
Oh, you said that. Sorry. Well, I can't see because I don't know who's saying what.
Yeah.
But, you know, my question is what's the benefits to Alaska? What are the benefits to my grandchildren? I see, like, you know, this in 2009. British Petroleum made a profit of $239 billion, you know? And this money is a profit, which means it goes to the corporations that we Alaskans would be subsidizing in a situation like this. And it's almost like, you know, you're saying you get 6 billion cubic foot of gas maybe per day coming out of this gas thing, and it's just going right into the pockets of corporate America, where especially oil producers, where, you know, we see them giving millions and millions of dollars to their CEOs and all, and I just wonder basically what effect are we just subsidizing big business in oil, or is this really makes sense for our grandchildren? And I think we need to start looking further down the line towards our grandchildren. And,
Peter, you're bringing up a whole lot of really good things and very interesting discussion points. But I want to say this one thing, and that is that the tariff is still pretty much undecided. This is the question that is going to be gone into probably in the future. In other words, the question of, well, where does the money actually go? What's the profit margin and whatnot? A lot of that's still undecided. But with that, I'm going to turn this over to Mark Myers.
Well, first of all, Peter, thank you. It's a great question. And it's the first questions Alaskans should ask is, how do they benefit from the development of their resources? Because indeed, if you look at the resources in the state and under the state constitution, that natural gas on state lands belongs to the people of the state of Alaska. So, and I really appreciate your question of how does this help the future generations, not just me today, but my children and grandchildren. I have two kids here that I hope will be successful Alaskans in the future as well as they enter their college ages. So when you look at the question, here's how the state benefits. First of all, the state has historically not taken all the development costs of projects on their own. They have leased out the resource and then gets a return on that from a share of that revenue from that project. And it gets it through a number of different sources. The first source, it gets it because it's being on state lands, it gets a royalty or percentage of the production or the cash equivalent from a percentage of that production. You know, in the case of oil and gas, it's anywhere between 12.5% and 20%, depending on the age of the leases.
And
of the value.
Some of these are already, if they have the lease, the royalty terms have already been.
The leases, yeah. For the Prudhoe Bay gas, for the initial gas in this project, those terms are already set. So that is money the state would receive on production that it's not receiving today. The second part are taxes. And taxes come in several different types. One is basically a severance tax on production And that's, you hear so much about ACEs. That's what ACE is about. There are property taxes, and then there's a corporate income tax. So all in, the state gets approximately about a third of the value of the project, in terms of return. In turn, the state does not put typically the capital investment into the project. The companies put the capital investment, and they market the gas, and the state basically gets a check. Where does that money go? On the royalty share, 75% goes directly in the general fund and funds operations. 25% of it goes into the permanent fund. And that's, again, probably the biggest source of contribution to your children and your children's children, is that permanent fund has been built up from the royalty share, that $30-some billion that's in the fund today. The corpus of that all came from the royalty share of oil and gas revenues. And that will provide a significant new source of revenues. On the tax side, it could be, depending on the price of gas, several billion dollars a year of additional revenue that would go directly into the general fund. So that's the state's share, roughly approximately a third. Development costs, largely that's $40 billion, and the range is actually $32 to $41 billion for the project. The other benefits then, so the revenue stream for the state is tremendous out of this, and this will be, short of the oil revenue, the largest stream of revenue to the state, bar none, general fund. And again, the largest contribution to the permanent fund in the future. The second part of revenue that's really significant is that it provides the cheapest and most available source of in-state energy, in-state gas. If you look at the tariffs to get gas from off this pipeline to, say, Fairbanks, they'll certainly be under $2 and maybe significantly lower than that, depending. So if you look at bringing gas into the state, natural gas added on businesses, there's huge opportunities for industrial growth and businesses and jobs. And the third part, of course, everyone likes to talk about jobs. The pipeline, of course, will produce a huge amount of jobs initially during construction. During operations, actually not that many jobs, but as you see the natural gas pipeline at this scale produced, you will see more drilling, more exploration jobs, more upstream jobs, more support industry jobs. And again, we'll also be producing a preferred fuel for use for the country and for the state. The last part is, with natural gas production coming off the North Slope, you significantly extend the longevity of oil production on the North Slope as well. So because the integrated economics are better than the single economics of oil and gas by themselves, you actually extend oil production life and keep that oil revenue flowing to the state. So those are the major sources of revenue off the big project. No other projects bring in anywhere near that source of revenue because the scale is large. The good news is we have so much gas on the North Slope, we can afford to build this large scale of project and get the economies of scale, and again, the associated increase in revenue to the state.
Peter?
Yes, thank you. I understand what you're saying, and I still just scratch my head about the enormous profits that oil is making, and I feel like somehow we need to, as a state, make darn sure that we are not subsidizing some gluttons, and I think I really mean that too. And thank you very much.
All right, Peter. Thanks a lot for your call. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-TALK, 1-800-478-8255. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@aprn.org. And Mark, before we take a break here, AGEA basically structures the beginning stages of the gas line, but it doesn't have a guarantee of the stability of the state tax regime, really, would you say? And when the Denali venture started up, it's kind of assumed that AGEA, the terms of AGEA and TransCanada are kind of agreeing to a certain promise of a tax regime, while Denali is going to come along later and look for its incentives.
Real quickly, under AGEA, there was a lot of thought given into what's important for stability for the project, for the investors in the project, what's important for the state. And so in there were inducements given to the producers, and those include 10 years of fiscal stability on tax structure, as well as dealing with some substantive issues they had over the state switching royalty in kind to royalty in value, switching back and forth, which could have affected their capacity in the pipeline, create imbalances in their capacity in the pipeline. Also, the producers have historically been concerned about that issue of how does the state value natural gas when we leave it in royalty in kind. So it provided fixes to those problems that the producers had recognized and identified over the years as real showstoppers for the project. And so those were put into regulations, how to handle that. 10-year tax stability was given. In turn, on the other parts, that the project guaranteed the state would get the project moving forward through some major key benchmarks. And it also guaranteed certain financial conditions the pipeline would be required to do under the debt equity structure and under expansion to provide, make sure the pipeline provided full competition for other explorers and developers, and we could bring more gas into the market with greater surety, to guarantee greater enhancement of in-state gas for Alaskans, and to guarantee a lower tariff. That was the quid pro quo component that the state got for inducement. So real, and also a guarantee of these benchmarks, including the open season that we're in now, and including filing with FERC for a federal certificate, actual work products that they were required to deliver.
Right. So there's skin in the game both sides.
Yes.
Now, then you take a look at Denali, on the other hand. It's sort of we don't know yet.
No, we don't know with Denali. The bottom line is Denali has moved forward in parallel with AGEA, and most of us believe because of AGEA, that AGEA, in fact, provided a catalyst to move the project forward, and two of the producers that did not believe at the time they could align with Denali, with AGEA, decided to go their own project. But interesting enough, if you look at the open season that Denali has started, their terms are remarkably similar and generally favorable for the state. So just in those benefits alone, I think Tony Palmer, TransCanada, said the changes we've made in this project are save the shippers $500 million a year.
So during the open season, we're clearly going to get all these rumors. And one rumor that came out in the Houston Chronicle was, oh, they're talking. They're going to merge. You know, well, and so we asked Larry about it. He said, well, some reporter got overexcited here. But it seems like only a natural thing that they would at least discuss coming to terms. I mean, because money's being put out, money's being put down on both sides. And so it's something that can be negotiated. And then now's the time. Basically, you got your three major producers here.
The three major producers are fierce competitors. They have been very tough negotiators to protect their positions and interests. And so as this project moves forward, a couple of really good things have happened. First of all, if you look again at the open seasons with the Alberta options, they're remarkably similar. So the companies are obviously seeing these projects similarly. I will say, though, AGEA also has an LNG option that's lost on a lot of people, but there's an open season now for 3 billion cubic feet per day, 48-inch pipeline, and processing, upstream processing, to Valdez. So the one thing AGEA does differently is it honors the concerns and the needs and checks the viability of an LNG project. So there's full, competitive, compatible, credible open season for an LNG project.
All right. Well, I want to take a break here, and I want to thank you very much for, and you can just take right up where you left off when we come back as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender. In today's competitive business climate, the advantage lies in reducing cost and increasing efficiencies. A safe and healthy workplace reduces cost and improves productivity. To get started, contact the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Occupational Safety and Health Consultation and Training Program at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Well, It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking gas again. Yeah, we got gas. AGEA. We have the state AGEA coordinator, Mark Myers, with us, and we're talking about the competing open seasons, competition in general, geology, gas markets, financing, and, oh, yes, taxes, right, taxes. So, okay, yeah, you were basically telling me the differences between Denali and the Trans-Canada AGEA process, and I was saying, well, Denali just was putting all that off in the future, and then I raised the possibility, well, you know, maybe they really will come to terms because, as you pointed out, they're very competitive.
Yes, and I think ultimately all parties recognize you don't want two large pipelines off the North Slope of Alaska.
We're not going to see that, no.
But they will negotiate on their own time and their own schedule. I certainly think AGEA is a great catalyst, and the open season provides a great opportunity for that, whether or not they'll avail themselves of that opportunity or not, or whether they will stay in competitive mode for a longer period of time remains to be seen. Yeah. I mean,
because they are the producers. The ones that bid on the open season are the producers. And the producers all three of the big producers are involved in one or another venture. They probably felt like they needed, I mean, Exxon must have, you know, they must have sat down there in Irving and said, oh gosh, look, the other two guys are doing this. We better do something too.
Well, you know, the companies are very thorough in their analysis. And I think it does speak to the long-term perspective of the viability of North Slope Gas, that these companies would not invest the level of investment they have, put the effort into it if they don't believe in the long-term there's going to be a North Slope natural gas pipeline. I know there's some people out there saying it's just never going to happen, but I think you see these companies' actions, the actual actions, as differently. And again, if you look at the national perspective, what we talked about earlier with energy, this project really does make sense.
Yeah, you kind of sold me on that one, Mark. Let's go back to the phones here with Thomas, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Thomas.
Hello. Yeah, my name is Thomas Higgins. I'm a candidate for State House.
Hey!
And I would like to first point out that they are oil extractors, and they're extracting from Alaska, and they're gas hoarders because they're not getting the gas that they promised to market. But my real question I was calling about is, we're talking about lowering America's dependence on fossil fuels, and yet all this gas is going to Canada. How does the spending $500 million through AGEA help America by sending to Canada, possibly to work in and to develop the tar sands in Canada.
Oh, I was wondering when somebody's going to bring up the tar sands. Yeah, Thomas, what a great question. Thank you. I think we'll let you go because I know you're running for office, so, you know, just out of fairness.
Thank you.
All right, Thomas. Yeah, Mark Myers, there it is. That's the tar sand question.
Well, let me start by saying when you look at natural gas and how it's produced, how it's distributed in North America, the North American market's pretty integrated, including the Canadian market. They're our largest supplier of gas outside of the domestic market. That supply has been declining over time. We've seen a rapid decline, depletion of the conventional resources in Canada. Now, with some unconventional gas, they expect to be able to lower that rate of decline. But for the next 5 or 6 years, people are still predicting significant decreases in the amount of natural gas being produced in Canada.
There's something else I didn't know.
So we look historically, the Canadian levels are declining because their conventional resources are not going to last a lot longer. So in the same time, Canadian use of natural gas, as you point out, for tar sands and for Canada's growing as a country, and their desire, I think, to have lower carbon fuels will lead to more internal use of natural gas. That said, the gas is designed on the Canadian option to go to reach the AECO hub, which is I believe it's one, if not the largest trading hub in North America. And from there, it's distributed to the lower 48 and the Canadian sources. So if you look at this North American market as a bathtub, then the more gas that comes in, the more that is exported out. Conversely, the Canadians will make a decision internally as a country about the domestic gas as to how they're going to use it, whether they use it to retort oil sands to create oil, or if they use it for export. Now, under the old treaty under which this gas line, the presumption is that gas that comes into Canada goes out of Canada in general. Now, it's not molecule tracing of a molecule of Alaskan gas coming in, but that we'll still see the export of Alaska gas. So by and large, it's clear the majority of Alaska gas or its equivalent amount from Canadian sources will go to lower 48 export markets. That's not to say some of it couldn't be or wouldn't be used in the Canadian tar sands if they achieve higher market price or higher market value for it. The state historically has not dictated to producers what their markets are. Of course, the nation did on oil for a long time, where they said North Slope oil could not be exported. And then they lifted that export ban. So I guess the nation could put in requirements, but right now, since there is no national requirement, the state would really have no way to say that Alaska's gas, producer-controlled Alaska gas, would go to a specific market. On the other hand, I don't think it needs to because, again, Canada's one of our most valuable trading partners, and they have a great market export of gas, and they're looking to export more gas to Lower 48. At the same time, the Canadian pipeline infrastructure is far from full. So there's opportunities to use existing infrastructure, and Alaska Gas will help boost the use and maximization of that existing export infrastructure. So there's a win-win for them to export more of Alaska gases to Lower 48 as well.
I probably should have looked this up, and you may not know the answer, but how much of the domestic natural gas supply for the nation is coming out of the Gulf of Mexico?
See, I don't have that number now. It's a significant source. I don't hazard a number, but I would guess around 20-25%, but
so
I'm not sure. Don't quote me that number.
That's very significant. And so if there's changes in offshore policy, which seem possible, what happens generally, as I understand it, with gas fields is they play out faster than oil fields.
It really depends. Conventional gas fields can last, 10, 20, 30 years easily. Mm-hmm. Non-conventional gas fields, individual wells decline very rapidly, up to 90% a year for those shale gas wells. So you got to keep drilling more and more wells.
Oh, yeah,
wells.
Yeah,
so
I understand that. But I mean, when you're talking all the investment required to do deep water drilling to get into that dome, and then it peters out. I mean, essentially, you're saying you need with gas, you have to punch more holes.
Yeah. So with gas, we've seen major shifts in the lower 48 domestic supply. The Gulf of Mexico shelf, the shallow waters produce much of the nation's gas for a long period of time. That declined rapidly. Then more of it shipped to offshore, and a much bigger tranche of it shifted to the western states, to the Rocky Mountain Belt. Mm-hmm. And as we saw, the overthrust plays being drilled there, complex geology. Smaller conventional plays played out. Then coalbed and methane came in, and they learned how to fracture not shale gas, but tight sands, conventional reservoirs that are very tight, very hard to flow through fracture technology, and they dramatically increased the amount of production from that. And now we're seeing the third generation of that unconventional, basically from tight sands to coalbed methane to shale gas, and that's shifting more back to onshore in Texas and the Barnett. We're seeing some East Coast beginnings in the Marcellus, some of the Haynesville. And so we're seeing shifts back and forth on supply, but all of it's a challenge, and all this new supply is coming in when the base old supplies are declining.
Yeah.
So it's, again, to feed our energy needs, particularly when you see the increased demand for natural gas, is still a challenge. Now, there could well be enough supply of non-conventional gas. But Alaska gas, if it's price competitive, is very attractive because we don't have a lot of the same environmental issues or challenges they face with some of the shale gas and unconventional on water use and land use policy.
Right, yes. And, this fracturing is, granted, it's going on for a long time and they keep tweaking it. But nonetheless, the bottom line is it does really mess up water.
There are a lot of concerns about the fracturing, actually fracturing up into shallower aquifers. It's actually not been a huge problem yet. There's been a few problems, but it's been a very achievable technology. I think the bigger question is it uses a lot of fresh water.
That's what I'm asking.
4 to 5 million gallons.
The water that goes in has to come back out, or where does it go?
When you take it out, first of all, you have to use it, and you take good potable water, and it's basically non-usable. And it either has to be treated, substantially treated, or it has to be disposed of. So it's water you're taking, you're not using it like a power plant uses for heating and just heating and cooling, but where it's reusable constantly, you actually have to dispose of the water. And so it's in areas of the country where the water is valuable or limited, it can put a stretch on the resource.
It's absolutely fascinating talking to you on the geological terms here, Mark Myers, and I really appreciate it. You gave me a thumbnail of the gas market that it would have taken me a week and a half to try and research that out of the book. So I really, really appreciate that, and I'm sure that our listeners do too. Mark Myers is the AGEA coordinator for the state of Alaska. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, a local call on Anchorage at 550-8422, and email, which I'll get to in a moment, is talk@aprn.org. And we got some waiting emails, and here is Dwight, joins program from Nanana. I think you have gas in Nanana, as a matter of fact, Dwight.
Well, actually, not. Well, they not probably produced in the foreseeable future. But my question relates more to the existing gas that we know is there. And I'm taxing very quickly. My question is that this whole whether or not this whole AGEA process kind of begs the question whether the highest and best use of the gas is to export it as quickly as possible. In other words, is letting the major oil companies do the development, financially and so on, and basically decide a whole bunch of the questions about that is the best option for Alaska, or at least letting them do all of it. Because I'm thinking in my mind, imagine a future in Alaska where for 100 or 150 years, we have a stable energy. Well, the world does what it does. Alaska has this long-term stable energy source because we developed it in a different way than just to get it out as quickly as possible. And there's my question.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Dwight. I think that's a really important question for Alaskans everywhere in the state. First of all, Alaska needs to have a clear and balanced energy policy, and we need to find ways to maintain a long-term stable supply of energy at reasonable costs, environmentally preferable fuel to Alaskans, and that's clear. One of the challenges that we face of getting gas off the North Slope is the economies of scale. And so if you look at if your source of natural gas for in-state use is North Slope gas and you do not have an export line of large quantity, in other words, export it at a fairly significant quantity, meaning in this 4.5 BCF range, 3 to 4.5 BCF, the cost of transporting that gas becomes very, very expensive. And we saw that with the recent numbers put out by the expert team that did the work on the bullet line. They just recently released their economic analysis. And at a case that would feed basically all the domestic gas Alaska currently would need for the foreseeable future under most rational demand strategies, the cost of just moving that gas to, say, the Cook Inlet was about $16, $15.81, I think, was their number on one of their cases. And that does not include the cost of the gas. So if you can conversely look at the cost of moving it to the market in this project, it ranges anywhere between about $2.80 and $3.50. That's all the way to market in Alberta. So the scale is almost five times as much just to move it to Anchorage, say, in this case.
We have a similar question here from Carl by email, and it's the same deal as that. Hey, if we got 200 years worth of gas, isn't that Alaska's energy future right there?
So the question then becomes the economies of scale. If it's that expensive, does it work? And so that team's going to look hard at options to lower those costs or distribute those costs differently. But it's a huge challenge. And so a competitive advantage of economy of scale. The other thing is, if it's internal in Alaska, generally we haven't seen commercial parties yet willing to step up and to interplay. So it would have to be state built, and you'd have to use state funds of some sort, significant amount of state funds. And again, we're not tasked to work on that. The other group's working on it. So then you look at, but look at your question another way, is there are two ways to build that infrastructure. One is to use the export market and take gas off of that, and we could easily have 50 to 100-year supply of gas at the high rates on the North Slope. In fact, I personally believe, based on the USGS numbers and other numbers that we do, have that size of resource. If you were to take some of those funds and you would build a diversified infrastructure, you would build out your hydro, you would do the exploration locally in the Nana Basin, we would study more on non-conventional gas resources, we would look at underground gas, underground coal combustion, look at all these other technologies, and invest in a very diversified portfolio, we'd find, again, individual solutions for rural Alaska communities, because one size doesn't fit all. You're not going to get pipeline gas. We would look at expansion of propane. So we look at a robust energy infrastructure funded in significant part by the export dollars. We can build your 100-year future and still be able for our 200-year future potentially, and we could change the energy economics in Alaska. But that would take – it takes a lot of capital. It has to come from somewhere. So a diversified energy portfolio, I believe, needs to be looked at. The funding on this project could provide the funding to build that portfolio.
Dwight?
Yeah, I have a quick follow-up, which is the argument that it would cost more. It could be taken two ways. Yes, it could cost more to do this. However, stability is a lot of times more important in making these kinds of long-term calls. And so it might be very well worth the trade-off of having a more expensive distribution, but this long-term stability that would be relied upon by investors, by everyone. And I think maybe what I see is that even though we might generate a lot of revenue, seeing what happened, having been up here nearly all my life, seeing what happened with the oil, it was the money pretty much was produced and spent, and not for the kinds of wonderful energy future things that are suggested. So I'm asking, what kind of guarantee we aren't going to repeat the same syndrome? And I, so far, all the answers I've heard are not reassuring.
If I could just comment to that real quickly,
sure.
I think the opportunity to do it differently is clearly here, is clearly available. Alaska is really blessed with, you know, actually this last year with a budget surplus because of the higher price of oil. We know oil production is declining. We need to find a way to bridge that future revenue and to manage that as well. How we deal with it financially could be through the way we endow and use our permanent fund or other sources of revenue. Those decisions have to be made, though, by the legislature and by the administration. Certainly, I can't advocate a position in it being appropriate for me. I also think, again, it's up to the obligation when there's a new capital budget or new legislative budget that it that the people of Alaska get involved in that. But again, that's really through the legislative process.
All right. Thank you. And Dwight, I want to thank you for your question and your comment in Nenana. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Well, a fascinating information-packed show here. We're talking about natural gas again. And Mark Myers, the State AGEA Coordinator, has been kind enough to be our guest today. And let's go to Kotzebue. Mayor? Hello. Oh, sorry. Line 3.
This is Sikola Kawaiting, Mayor, North Side of Guerrero. Thanks for talking about this really important subject. And thank you, Mark, for your leadership and your expertise on this whole gigantic plan that the whole state's talking about.
Well, thank you.
So I have a question about the resource and how your plan is to make sure that that the connection goes to rural Alaska. We've seen a lot of resource development and the resources that come from rural Alaska, and we're the communities that have the highest cost of living. So it's really tough for me to see resource development and the benefit for rural Alaska. My plan for my question was, what is your plan and who on the team represents rural Alaska? And I don't know if you're the person to answer this or if it would be Tom Irwin with DNR or Pat Galvin with the Department of Revenue, but I wanted to make sure that when a pipeline like this is built, do you have any plans to have spur lines either to Northwest Arctic or Norton Sound or other parts of rural Alaska so that we could benefit? Because all we hear now in the in news releases, et cetera, is there's a pipeline, it's going to go through Canada and go to the lower 48. And what about rural Alaska? You know, and you talked a little bit about the fairness, and I know it's going to be difficult because you're looking at populations, numbers for how we're going to benefit to have this fair resource, but I was wondering what your plans are to provide this resource fairly to rural Alaska as it's going to benefit all these other folks.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. That is great. Those are better questions than I had. And we only got 2 minutes left. Mark Myers, what about the bush? Where does the bush come in here? There's not going to be a gas line to Kotzebue.
That's correct. The scope of this project is really just the large-scale infrastructure, the gas treatment plant, and the main line, whether it goes to Valdez or whether it goes to the Alberta market. At the same time, there were requirements put into GEA to assure that gas was available for export and export projects at significant scale for in-state use, and that there was a specialized tariff structure to get gas off the state in-state at cheaper prices. The actual responsibilities to look at spur lines and development, ANGDA had some of those responsibilities, and the governor appointed Gene Theriault from Fairbanks to be the sort of the in-state liaison and expert in the governor's office. So a lot of this integration between these various groups that are working these issues lies in Gene Theriault's office or his overall oversight and responsibility. We also, of course, have Alaska Energy Authority that's looking at a lot of different solutions for rural Alaska. In their recent study, they also looked at some gas options. We've looked at some propane along the river systems. Clearly, though, building pipelines over long distances, I'm aware of the cost to get from Walakpa to Barrow and to maintain that system, and that's been a wonderful system. We need to see if there are opportunities like that can work. But the really long-haul pipelines to relatively small markets are very difficult. So we're probably going to have to come up with alternative solutions. And, of course, that then becomes a funding issue. How are the funds the state receives from these projects used and how to help build out state infrastructure? And that comes back again to the governor's. The governor's call is Office of Management and Budget. It comes into the working groups of all these commissioners on energy and in rural energy. It also comes back to the legislature. And, again, the legislature has been investing more in renewables and other solutions that may be more effective in various rural energy areas. CNG's been looked at. There's been some other options looked at. But I think rural Alaska has to stay very diligent to make sure that it gets represented well in this discussion.
Well said. Thank you very much, Mark Myers, for being with us today. Dave Waldron's on the controls, Josh Edge and Paige Corona on the telephones. I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you so much for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by the Alaska State Elks Association, offering the Alaska State Elks Camp in the Matanuska Valley, available for weddings, parties, reunions, and other public or private meetings. Information at alaskastateelks.com. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.